This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, October 29th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
So in these final days, stay empowered, stay optimistic, stay united, because you too have a sacred duty. The duty to vote. It matters. Georgia, it matters.
After more than 3 years of campaign launches, primary contests, stump speeches, conventions, and debates, all that's left now is for votes to be cast and ballots to be counted. But nothing is easy this year, even the supposedly simple act of casting your vote. Because of the pandemic, there are new rules around early voting, and they're different from state to state. President Trump and some states are actively attempting to suppress the vote, from impeding the work of the U.S. Postal Service to filing lawsuits to limit the amount of time states are given to tally the totals. Still, people have been standing in long lines at the polls since September, and some 70 million ballots have already been cast. It could take days or even weeks to count them, which means that we may not immediately know the outcome of the presidential and other races. In a speech in Warm Springs, Georgia earlier this week, Joe Biden implored Democrats to vote despite the complications.
God and history have called us to this moment and to this mission. With our voices and our votes, we must free ourselves from the forces of darkness, from the forces of division, and the forces of yesterday, from the forces that pull us apart, hold us down, and hold us back. And if we do so, we'll once more become one nation, under God, indivisible, a nation united, a nation strengthened, a nation healed.
This week, we're focusing on the political dynamics in three disparate states. I'll talk with E. Tammy Kim, who currently lives in Missoula, Montana, and Charles Bethay, who reports from Atlanta. But we'll start with Peter Slevin, who has written extensively for The New Yorker about politics in Wisconsin. Hi, Peter. Welcome back.
Nice to see you, Dorothy.
You too. Democrats are on edge everywhere, and I imagine nowhere more so than in Wisconsin. In 2016, Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by less than 1%. So after the election, as I recall, Democrats were furious with her for assuming that she'd win the state and for her decision not to campaign there in the final weeks. This year, Biden he's hardly been barnstorming across the country, but he will be back in Wisconsin tomorrow, his third visit this fall. What did Wisconsin Democrats learn from 2016?
Well, you're exactly right. Hillary Clinton inexplicably did not campaign in Wisconsin during the general election, even though she had lost to Bernie Sanders in the primary by 13 points. Somehow her team assumed that she had it in the bag. The Wisconsin Democrats kicked into gear very quickly in 2017 and built the kind of organization that the state simply hasn't seen before. Working at the county level and even more locally than that to build a full-time staff. That paid off in 2018 when the Democrats won all of the statewide elections for the first time in many years, not least defeating Scott Walker, the governor. This time around, the Wisconsin Democrats have hundreds of paid operatives. They have many, many millions of dollars that they are spending not just to hire workers for the Biden campaign, but they're pouring money into the down ballot races for the state legislature. And there's some thinking that suggests that voters who are motivated to vote for their local Democratic candidates will also be voting for Joe Biden.
And Biden does appear to have a significant lead at this late hour. But then we heard this week on Monday from the Supreme Court, which barred the counting of mail-in ballots in Wisconsin that arrive after Election Day. How much of a difference could that decision make?
No one knows what the impact will be. In the April election, where votes could be counted after Election Day because of the pandemic, there were many, many thousands of votes that did arrive after Election Day. And there's some fear, especially among Democrats, that people will be mailing in ballots that won't arrive until after 8 p.m. on Tuesday, meaning that they will not be counted. After the Supreme Court decision, Megan Wolf, who runs the Wisconsin Elections Commission, said time is running out. She said this to voters. It is time to get your ballots in. And the Democrats, led by Ben Wickler, the head of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, said, time's up, get on with it. And if you have not mailed in your ballot, it's time to drop it into a drop box or show up in person.
Vice President Mike Pence has been to Wisconsin five times since July, and Trump has held more than half a dozen rallies there. Rural counties voted twice for Barack Obama before voting for Trump. So the two parties are competing hard for that vote. And Trump is also, as I understand, trying to make inroads in heavily Democratic Milwaukee County, where 70% of the state's Black population lives. We've heard so much this year about rural voters versus urban voters. Will we be seeing that divide play out within Wisconsin?
Trump's big problem is that he's losing support in the suburbs, and he's facing enormous energy, it appears, in Milwaukee and Madison, where Democrats vote most strongly. His hope, his path, is to find rural voters, especially rural voters, who did not vote at all last time. He's got to expand his base if he wants to win again.
What has the, maybe you could talk a little bit about the effect of Kamala Harris on the Biden ticket. You wrote about the Divine Nine, and I think our listeners would like hearing about that.
Joe Biden seems to have gotten a real boost in Milwaukee, especially when he picked Kamala Harris. She's a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha, one of the Divine Nine fraternities and sororities at HBCUs. And the Divine Nine sororities and fraternities are a collection of groups that have turned out. I spoke with voters in Milwaukee and in Madison and even in the small town of Fitchburg, who said that they are very much motivated by Harris's appearance in the race, in fact, inspired by it. And I saw that she's doing an event, a Divine Nine event, in the coming days. She really fired them up.
There were so many mea culpas after the 2016 election and about what the mainstream media missed about the mood of the country. So I just wanted to ask you how well you think the national press has done this year, and whether you've had any surprises as you've been covering this region.
Well, I think journalists, like generals, are always fighting the last war. And so probably every working class voter in America, at least every white working class voter in America, has been interviewed twice this time to make up for 2016. And time will tell what the reporters missed this time around. But it won't be because they didn't blanket the battleground states. The amount of coverage is quite extraordinary, even though there are still many things that we don't know. I spoke with a Democratic leader in Wisconsin who said he's afraid of the unknown unknowns because there are some things that simply can't be predicted, as earnest and hardworking as reporters are.
Thanks, Peter. Talk to you soon.
Glad to be here. Great talking.
Let's say we're losing the state of Montana. That'll never happen. And I get an urgent call from my people in Montana, and I'm in New York or I'm in Washington, and they say, sir, we're losing the state of Montana. Is there anything you can do? Can you imagine me saying, oh, I don't know what to do? Gee, let's call the Russians. Maybe they can help.
Hi, Tammy. Great to have you on the program.
Nice to see you, Dorothy. Thanks so much.
You're talking to me from Missoula, and when it became clear that the COVID-19 pandemic was going to limit in-person voting, Montana was applauded for the success of its mail-in voting system. In the 2018 election, 73% of votes, 73% in Montana were cast by mail. In this election cycle, despite a legal challenge from Republicans, mail-in ballots were automatically sent to voters in 46 of the 56 counties. Have Montanans embraced mail-in voting because so many of them live so far from polling places? And how does this affect how elections play out in the state?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the history of mail-in voting here certainly has to do with the rural spread. There's also been a fair amount of litigation from rural voters and Native American voters who are living in extremely remote parts of the state. This year has obviously been extremely politicized because as soon as the counties opted in to do that, there was a lawsuit from the state and national GOP. And so that's now been resolved in, you know, what is widely described as the Democrats' favor to allow that.
So in Montana and outside Montana, there is fervid interest in the Senate race. It's called the Battle of the Two Steves.
Yeah.
Democrat Steve Bullock, currently the governor, and Republican incumbent Steve Daines. The race is really close, one of the closest in the country.
Yes.
How is it different from other races in Montana's history?
So voting is extremely tight here and has been in previous federal races in particular. All of the races this year, though, are just, they're all nail biters. The governor's race, there's one congressional seat here. That race is also extremely close. We're all talking about within the margin of error. I think the pattern of votes being so close in the state has to do with the fact that so many people consider themselves independents. So, for instance, in Senator John Tester's reelection last time, that vote was decided basically by about 18,000 ballots, which is just tiny, you know. And so I think that sort of, you know, independent streak throughout the state is causing alarm on both sides once again. I think it also has to do with the fact that President Trump's popularity here has really taken a dive and how that's affected Republican voters. So he won by 20 points in 16. Now he's pulling about 6 to 7 points ahead of Biden.
This gets to the biggest peculiarity of American democracy, which is the Electoral College, which gives electors in states with tiny populations the same power as electors who represent enormous numbers of voters. So there aren't very many voters in Montana. And
right.
I still feel pretty uninformed about the issues, I'm ashamed to admit. What are the most powerful constituencies in Montana, and what do people want in their candidates?
You know, the story that I wrote for the magazine has to do with Native voters and union voters, who I focused on both because those voting blocks have been influential in the past. Again, in Tester's race, the Native vote was huge, but also because they're sort of the most organized. They are the ground game in this election, in which the Republicans and Democrats really haven't had the sort of canvassing operations they might have had in the past due to COVID. The Native American vote is about 7% of the state, or that's the population at least. And so, you know, whatever voting part of that is significant, and in sort of decisive rural counties, that's going to make a difference. And then the union membership. So Montana is quite unusual in that it's the only state in its region that still has a sizable union, you know, population and power. It is not right to work. And so the private and public sector unions have really mobilized in favor primarily of the Democrats here. Should also say that the veterans vote here is significant. It's one of the largest per capita veteran populations in the country. And people like Tester and Daines and Bullock have always made gestures towards that community. And so certainly I think veterans welfare, Native American sovereignty, to a lesser extent, I think the ACA and kind of welfare state issues are on the table. Montana did expand Medicaid under the ACA. And of course, that's now a sort of federal question of what's going to happen.
So Montanans, you sort of alluded to this, like other Westerners, have a reputation for political and social independence. So it is a pro-Second Amendment state, and voters, as you point out in your piece, are more interested in access to public lands than they are in climate change. But there is this, it is this bastion of unionism. There are a lot of mines in Montana as well. So there are a lot of things that go into the mix here. What kinds of reactions have you seen to Trump's presidency?
I think, you know, in terms of the guns and sort of other issues, you know, abortion, these sort of, I guess, culture war issues at play, I think the sort of symbolism around Trump and the Republican support for them is greater than the actual thrust of it in practice, given that the Democrats here are generally somewhat conservative, you know, nationally speaking. I think that sort of mythical population of the Obama voter that became then a Bernie Sanders fan and eventually voted for Trump is quite real here. And there are also, I think, a number of people who have seen what has happened under the Trump presidency. And although they might be sympathetic to his sort of outsiderness, are now fed up with that and are going to turn Biden. I wonder, though, what's going to happen this year, because I think, you know, how Trump and the allegiance to Trump will work itself out in the state and the federal races here. And then how, you know, just the familiarity of people like Bullock you know, or the distaste for people like Gianforte, who's the Republican candidate for governor, who is nationally and internationally famous for having body slammed a journalist a couple of years ago.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
A lot of characters in the state, but sort of how those things that, you know, in some ways don't align with the kind of the stubbornness, but also the niceness that people pride themselves on here will work themselves out on the ballot.
I was really interested in one of your reporting expeditions. You accompanied a candidate for state auditor, a Democratic Native American, into a conservative white gated community in Missoula. And I wondered how that went.
So Shane Morajo is a sort of fascinating candidate. He is the only Native candidate on for a statewide race. And he belongs to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes out here and is a devoted gun owner. He has now 23 guns. He's acquired another one since I wrote my piece. But I followed him and his wife and his campaign manager to a trip to a gun range in a part of Missoula that is quite un-Missoula in the sense that there are Trump signs everywhere. Ban bullocks, save your guns is a sort of rallying cry of this particular range. It was funny because the first few minutes of our time at the shooting range, the sort of guy on duty at the range came over to inspect our guns, which we wondered because we were four people of color at the gun range. And he had a t-shirt that read, the Second Amendment, the original Department of Homeland Security, was sort of who you would expect to be at that gun range. And then a few minutes later, a guy drove by waving out the window, Shane, I voted for you. Good luck. You know, so I thought that was just a perfect 5 minutes of Montana life, that both things could be true.
I'm asking all of you the same question at the end here, which is, after the 2016 election, when the mainstream media admitted missing the most important story probably of their lifetime about the mood of the country, how do you think the national press has been doing this year?
I think a resistance to the national media here is rooted in, one, people's mischaracterization of Montana as a red state, sort of not understanding the long Democratic tradition or the sort of purplish politics that have long dominated and, you know, been evident in this kind of zigzag voting pattern. And I think the other is to not really think about the fact that in rural counties, just as in urban counties in these Western states, the politics can be very, very mixed. And so to just say, oh, all of the rural counties will go this way, I think is a mistake.
Thanks so much, Tammy.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
There aren't a lot of pundits who would have guessed 4 years ago that the Democratic candidate for president in 2020 would be campaigning in Georgia on the final week of the election. Or that we'd have such competitive Senate races in Georgia. But we do, because something's happening here in Georgia and across America.
Hi, Charles. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This week, Joe Biden invoked FDR as he gave a closing argument for his presidency in a speech in Warm Springs, Georgia. How was it received?
Well, before I get to how it was received, I think in terms of what it was trying to do, I think there were probably two main attempted impacts. One was locally, Democrats need to pick up 16 seats to control the state house. They also need to hold on to seats they've got, and Republicans are coming after some of those. One of those is in Meriwether County, where he gave the speech. So I think Biden, he hoped his visit would help Democrats in this long shot quest for a House majority. He also obviously needs to steal some rural votes from Trump, who has to get something like 90% of them to win the state. So especially given the number of white moderate suburban women voters who are probably joining Biden's base of support in Atlanta. So as far as how the speech went over, I haven't heard a great deal suggesting that it moved the needle much either way. Frankly, for all the boldness and symbolism, I kind of doubt it's going to swing more than a few hundred voters.
The white suburban women voters is such an interesting phenomenon. Can you just talk a little bit more about that in Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, the experts I've spoken to, including Charles Bullock at the University of Georgia, thinks that if we're going to see many Trump voters from 2016 defecting to Biden, they're likely to be suburban women, the kinds of voters who John Ossoff was really hoping would help carry him along in 2017. These are women who are probably put off by a lot of Trump's misogynistic rhetoric, perhaps by the Kavanaugh nomination, and they're less likely to I think, bide Trump's continuing concerning language around women, around race, etc. I've met a number of women who fall into that category, who sort of reluctantly voted for Trump in 16 and have shifted. So I think that's the sort of prize demographic that will probably have a lot to say with what happens in Georgia.
Georgia has a long, ugly history of voter suppression. We all know that. How has Stacey Abrams's group, Fair Fight, and other grassroots organizations fought suppression in this election?
Yeah, I mean, a brief bit of history. A federal judge ruled in favor of Georgia's removal of 100,000 names from the voter rolls, and something like 22,000 of these voters were ultimately added back. But meanwhile, Abrams and others have succeeded in registering a huge number of new voters. That's where their efforts have really been. And I think a million more are now registered in the state than 2016. And many of them are young and non-white and likely to vote Democratic. These voters have found themselves in really, really long lines. I've talked to people in predominantly black precincts who've waited for 8 hours and 10 hours to vote. There's been reports of broken and malfunctioning equipment. All of this has sort of the whiff of voter suppression. But this sort of structural voter suppression, if we want to call it that, I think is being overwhelmed by voter enthusiasm, especially among black voters. The Secretary of State just announced that he's expecting 6 million voters in Georgia this year. In 2016, there were 4 million.
Wow.
So it's a huge jump, and I think black voters anecdotally seem to be making up a pretty huge percentage of that jump. And if they exceed 30% of the total number of voters ultimately who vote in this election in Georgia, Democrats think that that's sort of the point at which they will think that they could win or will have won.
On the opposite side of the political spectrum, you recently wrote about Marjorie Taylor Greene, the QAnon believer, who overwhelmingly won the Republican primary in Georgia's 14th district, which is, of course, white majority Trump voting. Are Greene and her supporters outliers?
Yeah, that's the question. I mean, she was described to me also by a Republican who lost to her, a more of an establishment type in the primary, as Trump in heels. And I think that may actually downplay how concerning she is. She doesn't seem to have many core beliefs beyond doing and saying what's going to rile up her base. Many Republicans do think she's nuts. Eric Erickson said she's batshit crazy. Whether, you know, she's an anomaly or not, I think probably not. That's what a lot of folks who live in her district and are Republican and concerned about her think, that there's going to be more Republicans running for office in these conservative parts of the country, like Northwest Georgia, who are totally emboldened by her norm-obliterating campaign. So she's likely, I think, to be less of an anomaly than a precursor.
So Georgia has two Senate races on the ballot this year. You mentioned Democrat John Ossoff, who's challenging the incumbent David Perdue. And then there's a special election with five candidates, the front runners being Democrat Raphael Warnock and Republican Kelly Loeffler. Both races are very close. Is either one significantly driving voters to the polls?
I mean, I think voters are going to vote for Biden, and the degree to which Biden is able to sort of shift voter sentiment in the state, I think that's going to trickle down to Ossoff and Warnock, both of whom are facing opponents who are quite problematic. In the case of Ossoff, he's running against David Perdue, who got in trouble for enlarging Ossoff's nose in a campaign ad. Perdue also recently mocked Kamala Harris's name. Likewise, in the other race, Warnock is in this special election with a huge field. But like you said, it's largely just him and Kelly Loeffler, Doug Collins. Loeffler is doing the best between the two Republicans so far. And she's had to go really far to the right in order to try to secure a position in the likely runoff, because in Georgia, you have to get over 50% of the vote. It looks like no one's going to get 50%. So she and Doug Collins have just been having this sort of war. Collins is making a lot of the arguments Warnock will ultimately make as well, calling, you know, Loeffler someone who's willing to take Marjorie Greene's endorsement, who's said lots of concerning things about Black Lives Matter, who's draped herself in Trump, who said that Trump has done nothing wrong. All of that's going to be tough for her to sort of wave away, I think, if and when she makes it to the runoff against Warnock, who has a much more moderate message and who really hasn't had to do much attacking as the Republicans have attacked each other.
And Warnock is African-American. How has that played, and what message is he conveying in his campaign?
I don't think he's leaning too hard on race. He's talking more about conciliation. He's using his background as a pastor to talk about, you know, biblical lessons, how they apply, and which that's, I think, a very effective way to talk to people in Georgia on both sides of the aisle. Again, he's not sort of presenting himself as an attacker. He's presenting himself as an alternative to this, like, sort of extremely divisive, extremely charged environment that's trickled down from Trump to Loeffler and Collins. And I think there's something about him that appears, as with Biden, appears to be a really nice sort of alternative and return to quote unquote normalcy, rather than some sort of shift to a far left version of what we're seeing now on the right.
You've attended a few Trump rallies recently, and I wondered what's the mood been like compared to 2016, and what can we expect from his supporters on Election Day?
Yeah, I recently went to try to listen to Biden speak in Georgia a few days ago, downtown Atlanta, and I showed up early and was, I guess, not terribly surprised to find a pretty huge number of Trump supporters who were there, actually more than I saw Biden supporters. And they were doing what they've done for years now. I mean, they were largely white. They were very unapologetic. They had their signs. They had their air horns. They had their slogans. And they were really enjoying, say, talking about Hunter's laptop and all these sorts of things that, you know, you kind of expect to hear. And I encountered one of them in one moment that was sort of emblematic, I think, to how ratcheted up tensions have gotten even from a few years ago when I attended rallies. I was out of nowhere just called nasty things by a Trump supporter who was there. I was just simply watching, and he started calling me words I won't repeat. And then kind of I will say, a funny twist, as it turned out, I knew this guy's girlfriend. And when she showed up and I gave her a little sort of careful side hug, we were both masked. He was just utterly stupefied, and he was scolded properly for the name calling he'd done. It was just this very, I don't know, it was a moment that kind of distilled a lot of what's wrong, I think, with the Trump era, which is, you know, I mean, looking at someone as just a fake news ambassador rather than a human being who's there to just do a job and who actually is a real person.
So I want to ask you the same question I asked the other two, which is, What has surprised you the most in the region you cover, especially after all the mea culpas following the 2016 election and what the mainstream media missed about the mood of the country? I wondered how you think the national press has done this year.
Yeah. I mean, as far as what's surprising, you know, I've lived in Georgia most of my life. I can only vaguely recall the last Democrat governor, Roy Barnes. You know, but despite the havoc wrought by the bungled pandemic response, despite Trump's often evident disdain for Southerners, despite the changing demographics of the state, Georgia just still feels very Republican to me outside of Atlanta where I live. And I get out of Atlanta a lot, so I'm very aware of the rest of Georgia. So frankly, I'm surprised by my own reporting and by the polls that show that Biden's ahead. I mean, I don't think he's ahead by 5 or 7 points here, as we've seen with a few polls lately. But I think Georgia really could turn the corner. And I honestly didn't think that even 3 or 4 weeks ago. As for the national reporting that we've seen, and maybe where there have been some blind spots or errors, the Times in particular has done what I think is somewhat thin reporting on Trump voters in the suburbs, where they've tried to advance this argument that they're sticking with him because of a law and order message in the wake of protests that we've seen about racism and police violence. And I just don't think that's very persuasive based on my own reporting or the polls on that subject. I think Trump voters are sticking with Trump because that's what they do. And very little can dislodge this fact beyond what we just talked about, the pandemic, I think finally arriving at the front door of some of these folks.
Thanks so much, Charles.
Thank you.
Charles Bethea is a staff writer at The New Yorker based in Atlanta. Peter Slevin, a contributing writer for The New Yorker based in Chicago, teaches at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism and is the author of Michelle Obama, A Life. E. Tammy Kim, a former member of The New Yorker's editorial staff, is a reporter and essayist currently based in Missoula, Montana. Election Day is this coming Tuesday, November 3rd. It's too late to vote by mail, but you can go early or on Election Day. Remember what John Lewis said.
Your vote is precious, almost sacred. It is the most powerful nonviolent tool we have to create a more perfect union.
This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.